You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hey, it's Andy, Mike, and Jason of the Fantasy Footballers Podcast here, and we're inviting you to join us live on NFL Plus following the first round of the NFL Draft. Look, fantasy football, let's be honest, gentlemen, it kind of rules the world.
That's right, and we will be live with in-the-moment fantasy football reactions to all the first-round selections and all the crazy surprises. We never can predict what's going to happen on that first day of the NFL Draft.
Lots of elite talent at the skill positions that will have a big impact on fantasy football this year. Are we going to get 3 wide receivers in the top 10? Are we going to break the record for the most wide receivers in the first round? Is there going to be a running back? I don't know.
And there's a lot of teams like the Chiefs, the Bills. We're really excited about their quarterback. Do they add a wide receiver? What are some of those best landing spots?
The Fantasy Footballers Draft Special will air exclusively on NFL Plus on Thursday, April 25th, following the conclusion of the first round of the draft. Go to plus.nfl.com to sign up today. Terms and conditions apply.
Take it away, Robert Evans.
Gosh, it could happen here.
Wow.
I did it.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love that, really.
You're
Robert Evans. We also have Christopher Wong, Garrison Davis, and we have Andrew here with us, who will be leading this episode. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. Hello, everyone. How's the weather?
It's so hot.
In Portland, it is cold. Everywhere else in the continental United States, it is a boiling hellstorm.
Yes.
Actually, today it's only 84, but we have 3 days where it's barely in the 80s, and then it goes back to being like 97 again.
Yes.
It's very exciting.
Same with Los Angeles.
I do not understand your temperature measurements, but
same with Los Angeles. It's lovely today. It'll be lovely for the next couple days, and then we'll be burning.
36 is 97.
It's going to be perfect here forever. Climate change is over in Northern Oregon. I have declared it.
Well, if you declared it, it must be true.
Exactly. So today, I want to have a bit of a discussion, an open discussion about my favorite kind of discourse, and that is dead discourse.
Cool.
I wanted to talk about a discussion, quote unquote, that people have been having a couple weeks ago about restaurants.
Restaurant discourse.
This whole idea that people heard about 5 minutes ago and got super riled up over and sparked a whole bunch of like drama because that's what social media incentivizes. But I figured, you know, we could have a nice roundtable discussion here about quote-unquote restaurant abolition and share our thoughts on the ideas presented in the zine that inspired it, for those of us who read it, Abolish Restaurants by Pro-Lan-Info. But first of all, I wanted to share a bit about my experience in the food industry. It was quite brief, and by brief I mean like 4 days. I started working at this winery / cafe that was owned and run by this trust fund baby. And it was very clear that she had failed up for most of her life. It was very disorganized and very stressful experience. I quit like a few days after I got it because instead of, you know, making coffees and preparing wines and stuff, I got a job pushing paper in an office, which is only marginally better. And I mean, I don't want to speak over like food service people or anything because like my experience is very limited. But in my own limited experience, it sucked. I mean, my blood turned to water trying to keep up with everything. It was one of those kind of under-the-table jobs where you don't have a contract or a specific job description. It's just like you're doing everything. So you're sorting and taking out recycling, you're organizing stock, you're making coffee, you're bussing tables, you're cashing products, you're handling accounting for some reason. Like, lady, I just got here, but I'm already doing accounting. And so on and so forth. I didn't have an official break either, and I wasn't allowed to sit at all. I mean, my boss said that I could stop for lunch when I needed to, but because of these constant like responsibilities she was piling on to me, I basically never got a chance to take a breather. The one time I did take a lunch break, she rushed me out to the lunch break because I was taking too long. And she was busy taking care of her other real estate. And her only consistent customers were her friends, and yet somehow, you know, she kept the doors open and the lights on because, you know, trust fund baby. But yeah, to reiterate, it was a very sucky experience.
I
what about you all? You all had any?
Yeah, I worked at a restaurant for starting when I was in high school. I was 15 and a half for 3 or 4 years, part of college. It made me learn a lot about how awful people are, but it was like you did learn how to work in a team and things like that, helpful skills there, but management was terrible. Not exactly easy work, not exactly fun work. Yeah, it was... Like, I honestly feel like a lot of people should have to do some type of job like that so that they learn, you know, how to treat people who work in that kind of position. Because mostly my memories of it is terrible, horrible customers who just treated people like scum.
Yeah.
But I needed the job. So, yeah.
Yeah. My only experience in food service was working at a Sonic. Not for a crazy long time, but it was terrible. And it left me with an abiding, like, respect for people who have to do that. And we'll talk more about the restaurant thing, but I certainly don't think fast food restaurants are a thing that exists in my ideal future, because I don't know how you could possibly operate those without a tremendous amount of human suffering and wasted potential, because they're just... They're bad things. Now, that said, any utopian society will have a way to acquire Popeyes, but perhaps not at like midnight in every city of the country whenever you want it. You
My
know?
Utopian society is a world in which KFC has been abolished and everything else still exists.
Well, yes, yes.
Well, that's the episode, everybody. Thank
yeah,
you for
that's
joining.
The episode. Again, this is It Could Happen Here, sponsored by
like
Carl's Jr.
I'm perfectly okay with imperialism, but like, I need
but
some
no
Wendy's
KFC.
Fries, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Keep the KFC.
Andrew, what kind of, like, can I ask, like, what kind of restaurant? I know Robert said his was fast food. Mine was very, like, casual food. What kind of restaurant did you work at?
Right. It was like a winery / cafe. And it also served food. It was, like, attached to a hotel.
Got it. Oh, yeah. And the hotel part of it probably made it even
Yeah,
worse.
Her parents owned the hotel. And so she.
Oh, yeah. All right. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Chris, Garrett, either of you either work in the food service industry at all?
Yeah, I worked at a bakery for like a year and a half, mostly back of the house. But I mean, I would, you know, would end up washing dishes and taking out recycling and all that kind of stuff. But most of my work was designing recipes because I was more on like the food science angle. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I have a complicated feelings on like cafes specifically. I mean, I love anarchist cafes and like the idea of an anarchist cafe. I would love to like have one at some point.
Yes.
It's like operated by the workers, quote unquote owned by the workers.
Mm-hmm. With a shooting range out back.
But obviously there's
guns and buns. We call it guns and buns. You can get a croissant and you can shoot a 9mm.
If you want to fund my cafe, by all means.
Guns and buns sounds like the name of like a gym or something.
You want, if you want.
It does. Andrew's absolutely right. That sounds like a gym.
Guns and Buns is a breakfast cafe gun range strip club.
And apparently a gym.
As long as you fund it, you can name it whatever you want. But the people will
fund it, Garrison.
Obviously, the food service industry has
yes, has
a
we'll
lot,
just make it a
problems.
Cooperative. That makes everything else, right?
Sorry. Please continue.
But yeah, but like the food service industry has a lot of problems. But if I were able to go into a bakery like maybe like two or three times a week to just bake food for people and that helps me live the rest of the week, I would totally do that, right? So like it depends on a lot of factors, but I think like there's ideas around like an anarchist cafe, worker-owned cafe that would be like totally chill to work in it, to like be there a few days of the week making food because I enjoy making food, I enjoy baking, I like food science. But you know, when you start tying that into labor and exploitative labor practices and the notion of like having to serve other people, then it gets a little bit more tricky. And you know, less good.
Less cash money. I understand.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
but, you know, what's kind of funny about it, I would say is like, God, I lost my train of thought. Go ahead, Robert. Let me just think for a sec.
Well, so I mean, one of the things that I have noticed over the years, because I've had a lot of friends work as bartenders, as waiters and waitresses, there's a chunk of people who really like the work. They usually don't like their employer. They often have issues with like their manager or whatever, but like they like their coworkers and they enjoy the act of like doing restaurant stuff. I know that like, so one of the things that I did recreationally for years is I would go to these regional Burning Man events. And one of the rules there is like everyone pays the same thing to get in. There's no like talent. So there's nobody who's like paid to be there as an act. And there's no like exchange of currency allowed. But there are restaurants. There are people who like bake food and give out and like make and give out coffee. There's multiple bars. And a number of the people I knew who were like who would spend the most of their time, which is again totally their own at these events, volunteering as bartenders, were people who worked as bartenders and were like, look, I like serving drinks. I hate a lot of what goes along with being in a bar, but I enjoy making and serving drinks.
Absolutely.
There was this one really cool dude out in the middle. He was out because it's a spread out over acres of woodlands. There was just this guy I found one night alone in the woods at like a podium sized little booth lit up bar he'd made. And he was like, look, I am a very good bartender. What I do not like is making the same things every night for drunk people who don't know anything about a good mixed drink. So you and I are going to have like a 5-minute conversation and then I'm going to tell you what I'm going to make you. Based on like, it was fucking dope. Yeah, it was really cool. Like that.
Oh yeah, more stuff like that. More like restaurant pop-ups that are like those types of things are divorced from like this notion of like, you know, being served by a lower class member of society. Instead, it's people like sharing actual interests that they have, and they're not obligated to be there, or else they get, you know, or else they're not able to pay their rent. Right? There's lots of things in like a utopian society where we'd be like, yeah, I would totally be down with doing some kind of, you know, some kind of thing related to giving food to other people or preparing food or, you know, drink like mixed drinks. I like making coffee a lot, like espresso and shit. So like I can totally see that, but right now, you know, it's just a totally different field, by and large, for most people in, you know, the food service industry, and it sucks to work in the sucks to work in the food service industry.
Yeah, the food service industry is one of the most exploitative industries in the country. That said, the idea of gathering in public to consume food and beverages is fundamental to human beings, and we're never not going to have that as societies. So there has to be ways in which to have versions of that experience. And again, probably not the every 10 minutes you get the same three fast food restaurants that are open all night. That definitely does not exist in an ideal society. But in any better society, human beings will gather to eat and drink around each other because it's something we've done in every civilization that has ever existed.
So, exactly. Andrew, do you want to talk a bit more about the actual zine? Because I feel like a lot of people's discourse around the zine is not about the zine itself. It's about what the title of the zine is.
Yeah, because people should read the actual zine.
If you read it, it makes very reasonable arguments. The title is just intentionally provocative.
And what I've realized about intentionally provocative slogans is that the people who want to get it, you know, they tend to be drawn into those kinds of things. And then there's some people who see something provocative and it kind of shuts them down.
Yes, yes.
Some people see something so provocative and see it's like, I want to learn more. And then other people see it and they have like kind of a gut reaction to it.
It's like the backfire effect type thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, to get into kind of the history of it and just the idea of restaurants as the zine explores. According to the discourse, a restaurant is just a place to eat. If you sit down in the middle of a desert with a table and a chair and you eat something, that's apparently a restaurant.
That's not a restaurant. That is not a restaurant, but okay.
The definition of a restaurant is a place where people pay to sit and eat meals that are cooked and served on the premises.
Okay.
Commerce is a part of the definition of a restaurant. Yeah. Why do we universalize and naturalize things that are neither? That is my question. It's like what people do with the state or with capitalism or with police or gender. I mean, just like those things, the restaurant is an invention. But it's been crystallized and induced into our minds as something that is eternal, that is natural, that is universal. You know, when Kronk brought his buddy Brock a piece of chicken, that was a restaurant. You know, it's like we take these things that come from very specific modern capitalist context and we stretch them out over the entire human experience. If you look into the history of restaurants, the first restaurants began to appear in Paris in the 1760s. Even as late as the 1850s, majority of the restaurants in the world were located in Paris. And I mean, for those who know a little bit about history, Paris is kind of an interesting place where a lot of things happen.
Especially during that rough time that period. Span. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on there.
Exactly. I mean, elsewhere around the world, communal meals were quite common. People cooked communally and they ate communally and there were no restaurants. Specifically, before the invention of restaurants in Paris, around Europe at least, rich people had servants who cooked for them. Travelers had inns where their meal was included with the price of the room and they ate for the innkeeper and his family. And peasants, they ate their meals at home. And of course, there were also caterers for events and special occasions, and there were taverns and wineries and cafes and bakeries for certain foods and drinks. Of course, later on, all of those things, the taverns, the wineries, the cake, the cafes and the bakeries, after restaurants came about, those other institutions started to shape and bend into the sort of the mold of the restaurant that was established. Restaurant, based on the name of it, comes from this idea that they were meant to restore health to sick people. Restaurant, right? And they used to serve these small meat stews.
So by that metric, Taco Bell cannot be a restaurant.
I would argue that it is the only restaurant.
It's going to restore bowel movement. If you have any kind of blockage, that it will restore that. But besides that, I do not think it's going to restore anything.
Yeah, health-wise. Taco Bell is probably something like a laxatant. You know? But so why France? Why Paris? Why restaurants? It kind of occurred after the food craft guilds were abolished by the revolution. It was like this attempt to kind of democratize the food industry, you know, liberté, égalité, fraternité, all that jazz. And so, So restaurants never began springing up because all these former cooks of the now beheaded king and aristocrats, they wanted to work somewhere.
Sure, yeah. And
so, you know, in a restaurant, you could get a meal at any time the business was open. Anyone with money could get a meal. The customers would come and they would eat at individual tables, eat individual plates and bowls of food. They get to choose from a number of options. And they grew in size and complexity as they went along. They got a fixed menu.
And eventually, then, one beautiful day, we invented the Baconator.
Yes.
Yeah, that is the end. That is
fun
the
fact,
end
the Baconator was the first burger I had when I went to the US.
Wow.
Okay. I would apologize, but this country's done so much worse than that.
107 fun facts about Andrew.
Yeah, you know, it's a little thing to tune in and you get a little new fact that you could, I don't know, add to my Wikia page or something. But yeah. Yeah. It was mid, honestly. My brother makes better burgers. But yeah, that's besides the point.
Yeah. Nearly every burger that you can get at a fast food restaurant is mid.
Yeah. TGI Fridays had some good burgers though.
Now, so TGI Fridays,
a place to have a burger.
That is the place when you're in a town you've never been before. That's where you want to just show up and get absolutely shithouse drunk until 2 a.m. with like a bunch of strangers at the TGI Fridays bar, which is the Boulevard of Broken Dreams. Like, it's only people who can't hack it in a regular bar and weirdos traveling through town. I love a TGI Fridays bar.
Okay.
I was not aware of that stereotype. I mean, there's a TGI here in Trinidad, and I mean, last thing I knew, they had like some kind of karaoke thing going on. But yeah, it's probably the vibe. I haven't been 20 times. Anyway, I think this is enough product placement for one episode. I think we're really shouting out a lot of different places.
Speaking of
here.
Product placement.
Here's ads.
Sure, why not?
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having pink lady apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets.
if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
So, the growth of the restaurant came the growth of the market. With the growth of the restaurant came the growth of the market. Needs that were, you know, fulfilled either through a direct relationship of domination, like between a lord or a king and his servants, or a private relationship, like within the family, they were now being fulfilled on the open market. What was once a direct oppressive relationship now became the relationship between buyer and seller.
Now became an indirect oppressive relationship.
Yeah, exactly. a diffused oppressive relationship, almost. Because no one person, I would say, could really carry the blame. A similar expansion of the market took place over a century later with the rise of fast food. Because as the 1950s housewife was on her way out, you know, being undermined, and as, you know, women started to move into the open labor market, many of the tasks that were done by women traditionally were being transferred onto the market. Not to say that women still don't do the majority of care work in modern society, but as women started moving into the office, into the workplace, things started to shift with regard to eating and eating patterns. Now, the important point to note is that, of course, you know, the whole women moving into the workplace thing is kind of a white woman phenomenon because, you know, people of color, women of color, were in workplaces before then in large numbers.
Yeah, and there's a thing I think it's important to note here too, which is like part of what's happening here is that like some of the care labor that white women were doing gets transferred onto non-white women, and this has been one of the things that like I think we talked about this a long time ago in an interview I did with a nurse, but like for example, you see this with healthcare a lot, where like a lot of like union workers get really good healthcare plans from their unions, but those healthcare plans are basically subsidized by not paying women of color like shit. And there's this whole sort of like trend around this of sort of like you can, you know, if you're rich enough, you can escape housework, but you escape housework by essentially thrusting it on someone else who's like further down the social ladder than you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like a form of that that phenomenon people have been talking about, the idea of choice feminism. As in any choice that a woman makes is part of the feminist sort of movement. So I saw some discourse happening recently where people are talking about how a woman should have a right, if she's a housewife, that she should still be able to, you know, pursue her interests, which is of course agreed. And the solution being proposed to that was that the man, the breadwinner, would pay for a domestic servant to come and work for the woman so that she can pursue her other responsibilities, her other interests and desires. And so it's just kind of this...
Perfect. What a close
externalizing. Exactly. Because then this woman is working away from her family. And then, you know, it's just like, it's a messed up system. But yes, so as fast food restaurants began to grow rapidly, people began being paid wages for what used to be housework. And of course, as we know, capitalism could not exist without the billions of dollars of unpaid labor that women perform on a yearly basis. Modern restaurants emerged in the 19th century under specific conditions. They had to be businessmen with capital to invest in restaurants. They had to be customers who expected to satisfy their need for food on the open market by buying it. And they had to be workers with no way to live but by working for someone else. As these conditions developed, as capitalism developed, so did restaurants. And so at the root of this whole abolish restaurants discourse needs to be an understanding of where restaurants came from, their historical development. You cannot take them in isolation and project them, like I said, across all of humanity. Because it's only through understanding through its specific circumstances that we can transform it as we transform society as a whole. As we were saying, you know, there's a lot of things that are hell about restaurants. The way that work comes in, like, waves and rushes, a lot of slow time in between. We're either really stressed out or you're really bored. I remember working there at the winery, and, like, for most of the day, I just have to be, like, shifting around bottles on the shelves. I couldn't sit down and chill or be on my phone or anything. I just had to busy myself until a customer came. And customers never came.
Yeah.
Because it was a failed business, propped up only by her parents' money. But
did you ever get told the phrase, if you can lean, you can clean?
Not in those exact words.
Yeah.
Yes, in those exact words.
God, and every fucking manager who says it to you thinks that, like, it's their cool line. Fuck it. Anyway.
Yep.
Yeah. So you have to just, you have this constant thing of trying to look busy while having nothing to do. Or you try not to fall behind because you have 10 things to do.
Yeah.
Everyone is always working harder and faster. And of course, the boss wants to squeeze as much work out of the same number of people out as possible, you know? Like, you're pushing people to these ridiculous extremes, which is why it's a kind of stereotype now of, like, restaurant workers all being on drugs, you know? There's also this whole inhumanity to, like, employees being paid in tips. Now, as far as I know, nowhere is that as severe as it is in the US. But, of course, around the world, there are tipping cultures of varying degrees. And so when you have that sort of work where your living, your subsistence is so directly tied to, like, tips, not only do you have this sort of divide being created between the workers, between, like, for example, the waiters who make the tips and the cooks who don't make any tips, and they sort of had to compete against each other because the waiter is trying to get as much done as possible so they can make their tips quickly, so they could have their, you know, quick service, whereas the cooks, they have no intrinsic motivation to push themselves harder. And so it just becomes stressful.
I never got tips from baking in the back of the house unless some of the people in front of the house would, like, share the tips at the end of the day by their own, like, volition.
Yeah, and I know folks who worked in places where all tips were shared with the kitchen staff, and it seemed to be a 50-50 breakdown of this is really good and everyone gets paid fairly, and this is actually some scam by management to deny people a bunch of tips by, like, pooling them in certain fuckery that gets done. So, like, it's like any formulation of this inherently winds up being pretty abusive.
Yeah. And dividing, you know? Another interesting, and I mean, as you guys mentioned, stressful component about, you know, this line of work is, of course, the customers, which customer service people in general tend to hate. You know, whether you're working at a bar or you're working at a, you know, a restaurant, or even working in, like, sales in some sort of, like, retail store. Their whole subreddit is dedicated to how terrible customers are to workers. And so that sort of dynamic of service, it really changes people. I mean, customers can just as easily be working class as the people working in the restaurant. But there's still that dynamic that's created when you are the one being seated and served and the other person is on their feet serving you.
Some of the worst customers, in America at least, are working class and poorer folks who it's like their chance to be above somebody, like when they go out to a restaurant, so they can be extra shitty. Yeah, that is a thing that happens.
Surprisingly, there are even, like, restaurant workers who treat restaurant workers badly when they go to a restaurant.
Exactly. Yes. It's like someone gets the opportunity to be to exert the power, and they're, like, do it in this short amount of time. But
although I will say, I'm sure those are also the restaurant workers who treat people badly at the restaurant they work at,
including like some of the coworkers.
Some of the worst things that have ever been said to me were by customers at the restaurant job I had.
Not surprising.
No, and I was like, I was like in high school. I was a kid, and these were like grown-ups being horrendous. So,
like, I think it's like, I don't know, like when people talk about this, like when people talk about restaurants, like in the discourses, it's in a way that's like, it's incredibly abstract and doesn't think about the fact that like the relationship between the customer and the people who have to interact with the customers, the host, et cetera, like that is a social relation, and it's a social relation that the power dynamic inherent to it ascribes sort of different kind, like it ascribes different kinds of behavior to the people who are on either side of it. It controls like what you have to do as a server, like what the sort of performances you have to give, like the smile you have to put on, which is actually like that's the original thing of what emotional labor is, right? It's like the labor you have to do to make the person who you're serving like think that you're like happy and enjoying it and like having a good time. But then, you know, like on the customer's end too, it's like you get this sort of, you know, it's like, oh, this is your one chance to be on top of a sort of power relation. And like that specific thing is so fucking evil. It's like there's a story I think about a lot from Reddit and Chuang originally. It was about like one of the last emperors of the Tang Dynasty, like his concubine like loved Li Zhi, and like, okay, I get it, it's Li Zhi that gets really good, but like Li Zhi's only grown in the south of China. You can't really grow it in the north. It just doesn't, like, it's too cold, it's too arid. And so in order to get her Li Zhi, like every morning, they would send like the fastest riders like in China would like be sent by horse like to southern China and then back so that they could get the Li Zhi there in time, like for it still to be like ripe and like edible. And, you know, that's the kind of power that used to only literally the emperor of China had this ability, right? Like the emperor of fucking China could get this commodity and like force everyone in a chain to go do this thing for them. And now like everyone has that, like literally everyone has that power. Like every time you use Amazon, you have that power. Every time you go to a restaurant, you have the power to do this. And it turns people into monsters because like that's, you know, like the Chinese emperors are like, these are some of the worst people who've ever lived. Now, like everyone, like you, just like the fundamental basis of the society is there is a place where you can go and you can become the emperor of fucking China.
Maybe there's a problem with the idea of instant gratification being reliant on the exploitation of other people.
That doesn't seem right, Garrison.
Never mind.
That's horrifying.
Don't worry. Now, watch me as I order next day delivery on a $1,600 drone just to fuck around in my backyard. Like, yes, it's everything is fine in America. I am like of the opinion that the grocery store is like the primary artistic achievement of capitalism as a system. They are objectively marvels. And they're built on a river of blood deeper and wider than is it's like, it's a hyper object, right? It's like impossible to comprehend the full scale of cruelty that goes into being able to like, well, it is November 14th. I'm going to go get a fresh bag of grapes that have been genetically modified to taste like cotton candy.
Picked by people making cents an hour in in a country that's on the other side of the world. Yeah.
Yes, whose relatives are shot for attempting to scramble over the border. Yeah.
Yep.
That the grapes pass through easily. Yes.
I think that points to another, like, I think part of the dynamic specifically with restaurants that happens, which is that like, okay, like cooking takes time, right? And the less and less time that you have, the more like the more reliant you become on like on these services. And so like, you see this with like, you know, like China has like a particularly horrible like delivery culture. Like you can have someone deliver food to you like to the train, like a train will stop at a stop and you can have someone run a bag of food to you and then like leave and you just like you go to the next stop and you get off. And that happens because everyone's working 9-9-6. And so it's like, okay, you're working 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. six days a week. And you know, you literally do not have time to cook because you're working 12 hours a day.
Another good example of this is like restaurant people who work restaurants, like line cooks and chefs, hardly ever cook for themselves. They always get food from other restaurants because they're cooking 8 to 10 hours a day. They're not going to go home then cook for themselves. It makes the things that prop it up become necessary to keep the whole thing going. It's all like balancing super like precariously on its own weight.
It's equivalent to like if you're in a criminal syndicate making somebody you're working with tangentially shoot a man in the back of the head so that you both have blood on your hands. Like everyone, just by virtue of existing under it, like if you're working 60 hours a week as a fucking nurse during COVID or as a fucking line cook dealing with this surge of delivery shit, and then on your way home, you just want to pick up some like sushi from a fucking grocery store that requires ingredients from all around the world and is made by people who are not getting enough money to make it and is horrible for the environment and the fisheries and all that kind of shit. But like, what are you supposed to do? Like you just finished like a 10-hour shift. Like, do you not deserve like one nice thing at the end of the day? People can't, like, either you become a complete aesthetic, right? And reject and go kind of Ted K and live in a shack in Montana and reject all of these kind of modern conveniences, or you accept that, like, you're going to spend some time wading into the river of blood because otherwise the things you have to do to stay alive in this society are completely emotionally unsustainable.
Yeah. Like, and this was the original, like, before it kind of became this cop out for like just doing whatever you want. But like, this was the original there's no ethical consumption under capitalism. Yeah. was about like this specific problem that everything in the society, like even if you're fucking living in the woods in Montana, it's like, yeah, like where did your cabin come from? Like, where did your nails come from? Who made the hammer? It's like everyone's like completely dependent for everything on the exploitation of other people. And
yeah.
I mean, the one thing that gives me a little bit of hope is when Andrew was explaining how like restaurants came arise because of people who used to like work for kings and shit who then started working at restaurants because they still wanted to make food. It was like that evolution, taking it to the next step, is people who work at restaurants now no longer having to work under capitalist exploitation and realizing, hey, I know how to cook well. I'll just set up like ways to feed the community outside of this system of commerce, right? That is the next evolution. If you start with people cooking for the king, people then cooking in places where you pay to eat in this exploitative system, and then people cooking for people so that there's food around in like a community setting, right? If you follow that trajectory, that's actually kind of hopeful.
It's almost like we've come full circle.
I mean, in some ways, yeah. Like, right? It's if we just go back to like being
communal
places,
eating.
Yeah, like communal eating. If there's places around different communities, different towns, different like urban centers that have the capacity to feed people who are not able to cook for themselves that night or that day.
Yeah,
that's something that if it's there is ways of setting that up, which I can see being so much better than how restaurants work. You know,
yeah,
maybe people wash their own dishes afterwards. Maybe people do something to help with like prep or something, right? Like there's ways to make this that gives you the parts of restaurants that are actually really convenient without the exploitation. And so that type of like community cooking is something, I mean, you know, that's even similar to like how like a good dinner party operates. Just that kind of extended out across, you know, more of like a pop-up setting and say, hey, yeah, this month we're using all of these ingredients that are grown in our general local area, right? We're not getting shipped. We're not getting like strawberries in December shipped from halfway around the world. We'll make stuff that is available as it's grown,
yeah.
Or we can pickle, we can store food, right?
And like, yeah, and maybe we've turned the old defunct Walmart into a grow shelter. So once or twice during the winter, there are some strawberries, and everybody comes together and shares this marvel that the community came like worked as a team to ensure would be available. But you can't just go and buy 4 pounds of strawberries that are produced with their like twice the weight of the strawberries and pesticide in order to keep them alive in fields that were never meant to grow strawberry. Like, maybe that's not available all year round. Like,
yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hold up.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Let's get back to the point being raised about like ethical consumption and capitalism, because that's a really important point. The whole purpose of that saying has been bastardized, but it really is crucial to have a nuanced understanding of it. What frustrates me is that it's been taken and it's been turned into this justification. Like, yeah. Oh, it's okay that I buy from Shein. It's okay that I buy a $3,000 haul from Shein because no ethical consumption under capitalism. Or it's like where somebody goes and they engage in something that is not a necessity.
Look,
that is,
Andrew, you're talking around my 2.5 pound a day veal habit, and I don't appreciate it.
Yeah, that sounds like a problem.
Like, that's like some like Joe Rogan nonsense. Like, I eat 2.5 pounds of veal every day, and that keeps my brain running smoothly.
Look, cavemen,
I mean,
only
look, it
veal
worked
garrison.
Out for Jordan Peterson. So I mean,
exactly,
it did work for Jordan Peterson. He's doing great. Cries at the mere notion of Antifa.
I would do an impression, but it'll hurt my throat. So, moving on. Thus, I would say that, as we were saying, you know, that there really is potential. We see even under these conditions that people find ways to survive. You know, they create like these informal work groups that are not only able to come together and push back against management, but able to work together to create trust within each other. You know, you have, like, for example, waiters who would try a hand in the kitchen on a slow day, or a cleaner, or who might pick up a thing or two, a dishwasher who's trying to move up to become like a line cook. All these different workers, they do things subtly to try to undermine the unnatural divisions and hierarchies and between the skilled and unskilled in the restaurant setting. Of course, it doesn't always work because there are, you know, settings wherein the manager successfully created divisions, you know, whether it be the manager creating a division between different nationalities of immigrants, or, you know, playing upon someone's queer phobia against like queer staff, or someone's biases against, I don't know, I can't think of a third example, but there are ways that managers try to like sow these divisions between workers, and there are ways that workers try to push back. There are also ways that managers try to do the opposite, to create a community within the restaurant that includes themselves. So instead of fostering isolation and prejudice, they create a community that, especially in small restaurants, that involves them, that talks about, that, you know, the boss might share with them how difficult it is working and organizing for the business of the restaurant. And, or they might create like a special kind of restaurant focused on their identity. So they might create a restaurant for queer youth where all the staff are queer, or you have a restaurant for, you know, a black owned restaurant where all the workers are black, and you try to create a community based on this identity. But it kind of erases the unavoidable class interests between workers and management. It smooths over that dimension. So it becomes more difficult to organize and to speak up for your rights, because you're aware that the manager is a human and they too are struggling. Which kind of brings me to the idea of restaurants with no managers and the idea of cooperatives. The issue with cooperative restaurants is that they basically have to collectively take on the role of managers, managing themselves, creating those pressures and pushing those pressures upon themselves. They enforce the work on each other, and they have to work longer in some cases and work harder in some cases, because the structure of a restaurant is designed to make money. And if it is not making money, then everybody loses their job. So due to this pressure, a boss is in a position where they have to pushed workers to get as much out of the workers as possible. You erase the boss from the equation, but you keep the rest of the concept of a restaurant, and the line between worker and boss becomes blurred to the extent where it's almost like that image of a person with a boot on their hand holding a boot on their head, where this oppression that was once external becomes internalized, because that is how a restaurant survives, through oppression, through exploitation. It's kind of like with how self-employed people are under capitalism. Yes, you're working for yourself and you have some freedom in that regard, but you're still restricted by the broader system. You haven't escaped it. You've just had to navigate it.
Yeah, and you have to make quarterly payments to the IRS.
Yeah, I mean, most of us here, I think, work for ourselves in some capacity or have a certain level of freedom. And it, you still have those pressures. And it's just, you have to inflict them on yourself. You know, you don't have like a break that has been mandated. And so, at least in my case, I don't take breaks because that's just how I am. You know, you work longer hours, you push yourself harder and harder, you work on days when you should be resting, and it's just, it illustrates the fact that liberation is not to be found under this system. And it's something totally new, with a totally different metric of success, a totally different metric of sustenance, totally different bare minimum, and totally different motivation needs to be the foundation upon which society is built. Because there's profiting now we can.
Yeah, and I think there's a, like, I think the reason this debate happened, like, this whole discourse happened in the first place was just that, a lot of it really was just a complete inability to imagine, like, literally any other way of, like, even just, like any other way of getting food that does not involve you going to a place and telling someone to make it for you. And, like, that, I don't know, like...
Yeah.
It's, I don't know, like, the fact that there have already been sort of seismic shifts in the way that, like, food production happens, right, I think is evidence of, like, no, we don't have to do it like that. Like, we just do not. It wasn't like this for most of human history. We could do something better than whatever they were doing before it.
Yeah. A lot of people might, you know, wish for, like, in this... So there's a shift over into the abolition section of it, the restaurant abolition. A lot of people look to, for example, a union as a path by which in the short term, you know, we make certain gains, and in the long term, we can take over and radically transform it. The difficulty comes in how unions have traditionally operated in the restaurant sphere. They tend to be significantly less successful. I mean, restaurants usually have very high turnover. People only last a couple of months. They often employ, like, a lot of young people who are just looking for part-time or temporary employment. A lot of people who do work there are constantly looking to move on to better things. And so it makes it difficult to create a stable union with a stable membership that can buckle down and really negotiate and push for the interests of the people working, because people working are constantly changing.
I think one of the really grim things it's led to is that, like especially when fast food took over, like the major unions that even do exist were just like, nah, we're just not going to bother even trying to organize these people because they just assumed it was impossible. And so, like, there are very, very few fast food unions. I mean, like, I think one of the only, like, even sort of functional ones is the IWW, like, organized Burgerville, but that's been, like, it. Like, the big unions, when they've done campaigns for fast food workers, it's like, it'll be something like Fight for 15, but it's like they're not actually trying to, like, form unions of these restaurant workers. Like, they're not even trying. They're just trying to, they're using them for sort of, like, lobbying and advocacy.
Yeah. And the difficulty also comes when a union is established itself, you know, because a union structurally is not always by all the workers. You know, there's still sort of a hierarchy or bureaucracy that may establish itself and try to maintain itself, even if it starts off benignly.
No, just for all of the radical history that unions do have, quite a few unions in the United States, particularly in the United States, have also been conservative bastions and bastions of different attitudes about, like, stuff like white supremacy. You know, there's a lot. The union movement is as much Blair Mountain as it is trying to stop black people from being able to work on trains. You know, like, all of those things are part of the history.
Yeah. And I mean, I'll speak briefly on, like, the union situation in the Caribbean, particularly in Trinidad. The trade union movement was inextricably tied with the anti-colonial movement and the movement for independence. The issue became that the unions became tied up with the political parties that arose after independence and, well, during the process of independence. What ended up happening with the unions was that they ended up being tied so deeply with the political parties that it ended up being that the established unions are, you know, the higher ups in those established unions, they have these relationships of favors and obligations with the politicians. A lot of politicians come out of these union movements and end up establishing their own political careers. And because it's all so tied up, when, you know, workers get into these industries that do have union, have been unionized, there's a very clear separation between the union and the workers. Because while the union is able to, you know, push for the workers' rights and, you know, they're still separate from the workers. The union still exists as a negotiator between the workers and the management. And so even if the workers wish to go beyond just negotiating, the union exists almost as a release valve for any sort of class antagonists, so any kind of pressure, any kind of real pressure against the status quo. I mean, it's not just unique to Trinidad or to the Caribbean. I mean, it's globally, across history, we've seen union struggles kind of go over the same sort of dynamic. You know, new generations of workers, they build up the movements, they build up the unions, and then the unions begin to change, and perhaps new union leaders spring up to replace the old union leaders. When put under the same position, under the same pressures, they react in the same way, and so the bureaucracy ends up being rejuvenated. Unions are reformed, and they end up going back to the same old ways that they had been before. And in some cases, the fight to reform the union takes the place of the fight against the boss because of all the bureaucracy and system of obligations and just deeply rooted ideas about the place of the union. Because while unionizing is a difficult process, union leaders do tend to enjoy certain benefits from their position. And as we are aware of, you know, certain hierarchies are self-justifying. Those at the top tend to want to perpetuate it. It's kind of like, and so this idea that, and this is just kind of an unsettled thought of mine, but it's kind of like the idea of, you know, using the state to establish workers' power and then abolishing it afterwards. You know, using the union to get some measure of workers' power, but then expecting this union of a certain structure that exists toward negotiating ends to somehow push in these sort of more radical directions. There's a saying that the zine, the writers of the zine say, it's like, restaurant unions need there to be restaurants, and we don't. I think that sort of applies more broadly, because when we get into like the whole idea of like work abolition, it's just concept of workers are people outside of work, but a workers' union exists within the confines of work as we understand it. And so I think that's where the difficulty lies. The zine goes on to say later on that every time we attack the system, but we don't destroy it, it changes, and in turn changes us and the terrain of the next fight. Gains are turned against us, and we are stuck back in the same situation at work. The bosses try to keep us looking for individual solutions or solutions within an individual workplace or an individual trade, but the only way that we can free ourselves is to broaden and deepen our fight. We involve workers from other workplaces, other industries, and other regions. We attack more and more fundamental things. The desire to destroy restaurants becomes the desire to destroy the conditions that create restaurants. We aren't just fighting for representation in or control over the production process. Our fight isn't against the act of chopping vegetables or washing dishes or pouring beer or even serving food to other people. It is with the way all of these acts are brought together in a restaurant, separated from other acts, become part of the economy, and are used to expand capital. The starting and ending point to this process is a society of capitalists and people forced to work for them. We want an end to this. We want to destroy the production process as something outside and against us. We're fighting for a world where our productive activity fulfills a need and is an expression of our lives, not forced on us in exchange for a wage. A world where we produce for each other directly and not in order to sell to each other. The struggle of restaurant workers is ultimately for a world without restaurants or workers. And I mean, do I think people are still going to call some alternatives to restaurants anyway? Probably. But I hope this discussion has caused people to kind of deepen their approach to this issue.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey, it's Andy, Mike, and Jason of the Fantasy Footballers Podcast here, and we're inviting you to join us live on NFL Plus following the first round of the NFL Draft. Look, fantasy football, let's be honest, gentlemen, it kind of rules the world.
That's right, and we will be live with in-the-moment fantasy football reactions to all the first-round selections and all the craziest surprises. We never can predict what's going to happen on that first day of the NFL draft.
Lots of elite talent at the skill positions that will have a big impact on fantasy football this year. Are we going to get three wide receivers in the top 10? Are we going to break the record for the most wide receivers in the first round? Is there going to be a running back? I don't know.
And there's a lot of teams like the Chiefs, the Bills. We're really excited about their quarterback. Do they add a wide receiver? What are some of those best landing spots?
The Fantasy Footballers Draft Special will air exclusively on NFL Plus on Thursday, April 25th, following the conclusion of the first round of the draft. Go to plus.nfl.com to sign up today. Terms and conditions apply.